It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Over the last week, the USDA confirmed cases of a highly pathogenic avian flu in Texas, Idaho, Michigan, New Mexico, and Kansas among cows. They also confirmed at least one case of human transmission in Texas found in a person exposed to infected dairy cattle. While the strain of avian flu has been very dangerous to birds, so far it doesn't look as dangerous for cows or for people. Our next guest is an expert on human and animal infectious diseases. We're taking a look at the latest on this virus and efforts to prevent it from spreading. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in agriculture yourself? Have you encountered avian flu in a poultry, maybe poultry you've worked with? Are you worried or do you have questions about the idea of this avian flu spreading to cows? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Keith Polson is director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory and clinical associate professor in the Medical Sciences Department at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Keith, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Gave a couple of the very basics about this. Tell us a little bit more, please, about this avian flu being found, at least in some, cows.
You know, it's a pretty interesting finding, considering that this strain of avian influenza has been circulating in North and South America now since 2022. It's not very predictable about when we're going to see domestic poultry have issues. We saw in the spring of 2022 and then the fall of 2023. And we also have seen now nationwide about 130 different mammalian species and then some of our raptors like bald eagles and owls and hawks. But most of those mammalian species are carnivores, or what we call mesocarnivores, and they're scavengers. So when you think about bobcats out in the field, or even eagles when they're scavenging dead birds, and that's where we saw some mortality due to neurologic disease. So we saw brain infections. This example, and that's really what we saw in the goat kids in Minnesota. Oh gosh, that's probably 3 weeks ago now. And now this is a more of a novel presentation of this viral strain in ruminant species in our dairy cows. Now we've been seeing increased cow illness in Texas now since the beginning of February, but it took the industry and the diagnosticians around the country a few weeks to really recognize and rule out all of the common pathogens, mm-hmm. and then to really use some advanced technology to find that the current circulating strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza is associated with and potentially a component of why these cows are getting sick.
Now, this same virus affects different species differently, clearly pretty devastating in some cases for poultry here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. How does it seem to affect dairy cows so far? Obviously, an issue of great importance here in Wisconsin.
Right. And I think that's really why Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, we've been involved with this since the beginning, because a lot of our growing heifers or our young replacement females are raised in Texas and Kansas. And, you know, cows are very different. And here's what the really interesting component of this is that typically when we see disease or infections on a dairy farm, be it salmonellosis or let's say just a bovine viral diarrhea or something like that, it's usually in our younger animals, or then we see it in our high stress animals, which are right about the time that they're calving, because there's a lot going on when they're transitioning from a dry cow to a lactating cow. The cows in Texas and Kansas, and now we're expanding to Ohio, Michigan, and Idaho, and we could talk about that later, but these cows are typically, the cows that show clinical signs are those that are in their second lactation or more. So that means that they're usually 3 or 4 years or older, and they're usually 150 days in milk, meaning they calved at least 150 days ago. So they're coming off the peak of their lactation. They're getting into mid and late lactation. We're not seeing clinical signs in any young stock, any pregnant animals that are not lactating. No replacement heifers, no beef cows, no beef calves, no dry cows, and no transition cows or those cows that just had a calf, which is really interesting. It's a completely different way of thinking about or a different presentation of viral infections in dairy cows.
And then for those dairy cows at that stage, as it sounds like a very particular category at a very particular timing, when they've had this avian flu, when we've been able to detect it, do they recover? What's been the impact on them?
Yeah, and this is why, you know, most of the media and the coverage is really about this is high path influenza, avian influenza in cows. And it is the same strain, but we're not really seeing high pathogenicity. And, you know, here's the interesting part is that typically cows wear pedometers and they wear collars that measure how well their stomach motility, their rumen motility and feed intake is, just like, you know, wearing a Fitbit or an Oura ring or an Apple Watch. And that's usually the first thing that that happens with these cows is that those monitors and the computers will pull a cow to say, hey, she's not eating the same as she usually is, so you should take a look at her. Then the next thing that happens is as the cows go through the milking parlor, the parlor is actually measuring how much milk they have, and then they do a milk conductivity, so they actually run electricity through the milk sample. And as those cows, their feed drops, just like when anyone else is sick, you know, your feed intake kind of comes down or you're not really hungry. And then the cows don't make as much milk. So their milk conductivity score rises. And that's another way that the parlor will actually pull or sort a cow for further evaluation. And then when a veterinarian or a herd owner or employee goes in to look at their cows, we're seeing about 10% of that very kind of select population of cows, up to 10%, they'll have a fever. And they'll have a fever of anywhere from 103 to 105. There's some outliers that get a little warmer.
How bad is that for a cow? I'm going to stop you there. Yeah, that sounds bad for a human.
Yeah, great question. So a normal body temperature for a cow is 101.5.
Okay.
So really, yeah. So it's like having 100 to 101 fever for a person. So, and then they'll decrease in their milk, and they don't have mastitis or infection or inflammation in their udder. But their milk they do decrease in production, and the milk is a little bit thicker and it turns more yellow, similar to colostrum. So, and then to kind of get back to your question to beginning is that, you know, these cows recover. They have a very low mortality rate. We have not seen dead cows, which is very different than when we see this virus in domesticated poultry. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say it, you know, it's kind of a misnomer to say highly pathogenic avian influenza in the cows, because they do get sick, and it's, you know, and I don't want to downplay that because it really is hard on the cows, and that milk production decrease is really important for farmers. But the cows do recover. The cows that are later in lactation and later in their lactation curve, you know, they typically recover within 10 to 12 days. But those cows that are later in their lactation, they tend to not recover their milk production. So often those cows are sold to go into the meat food chain, mainly because the beef price is really high right now and milk price is at historic lows, and it has been very low for a long period of time. So there's a lot that goes into it.
We're talking to Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, clinical associate professor in the medical sciences department at UW-Madison's School of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about cases of bird flu, the one you've heard of affecting poultry in the United States, being found in dairy cattle in parts of the U.S., and what we have to worry about, what kind of precautions, we'll look at that coming up, we can take. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? If you work in this industry, are you worried? Are you taking precautions? What kind of precautions do you usually take to make sure diseases don't spread to and among your livestock? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, looking at avian flu. It's spread a lot and done a lot of damage in the poultry business. It's been found in dairy cattle. Seems less dangerous there. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Christina is with us in Glenwood. Christina, hi.
Hi there. Thank you. If a cow is being culled for slaughter due to avian flu, how safe is that meat for either humans or dog or cat food?
Good question, Christina. Keith, yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's probably one of the most important talking points of this disease outbreak in our cows, is that pasteurized dairy products are absolutely safe. And the meat products that come from the cows are also safe if properly cooked. So that's really no different than any of our ongoing or current standards for food safety, is that we want to, you know, drink pasteurized dairy products, or use, you know, eat ice cream. That comes from a pasteurized dairy product as well. And then we cook our meat as what's on the label.
Thanks for the call. Christina, you specified pasteurized. There is a market for unpasteurized or so-called raw milk. I think the health advocacy folks worry about that in general. Is this another worry, this potential avian flu being spread by it somehow?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And while we don't have retail sale of raw milk in Wisconsin, we have a lot of incidental sale. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a lot of demand for that. And we've worked with that over and over. And that, as a public health issue, I would not recommend drinking raw milk or feeding it to a family, especially those that live in urban areas. But really, in general, it's not a good idea for raw milk in general. This is just another reason why, is that cows, one of our best diagnostic tests for this novel outbreak or novel disease syndrome is we run PCR on our milk samples, and we know that cows are shedding virus in their milk that is very susceptible. Pasteurization is agreed by FDA, CDC, and USDA to be 100% effective to make that milk safe. And that's what's so important to our dairy industry. And drinking that unpasteurized, I think, would certainly not be recommended by our animal and public health officials.
Christina, thanks again for that call. Keith, as I mentioned, there's been one, I believe, confirmed case of a human exposed to cattle that are cows that have been infected with this virus, getting it, not super huge symptoms. It seems right now, at least, like that is a pretty major outlier. We're not seeing a lot of this.
Yeah, that's a good question. And that's actually the number two really important talking point, is that at this time, we do not see this as a significant public health threat. Now, influenza viruses change, they reassort, and that's probably why we're seeing this in cows now, is that we saw some genetic change in the virus. But we, you know, those, the one person that's been confirmed in Texas had direct contact with dairy cows that were affected. It wouldn't surprise me if there are others. We always typically have farm workers with high path, even on poultry farms, that might develop flu-like symptoms, but it's really rare for them to actually be confirmed with this strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza. And it really, there's some CDC and USDA have some really great personal protective equipment recommendations that really follow into the biosecurity guidelines of wearing safety glasses. Lots of dairy farm workers wear safety glasses anyway, safety glasses or maybe even a shield. We always wear gloves anyway, to really protect our cows so we're not transmitting bacteria or viruses from cow to cow. And then, you know, washing your hands. And really, that one case in Texas was a conjunctivitis. So as much as I don't want to downplay that, you know, they essentially had some inflammation in their eyes, because I'm sure that was uncomfortable, but it was really a low pathogenic finding.
Keith, what are you hoping for dairy farmers in Wisconsin when it comes to watching for and maybe reporting these kind of potential symptoms?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in Wisconsin, we typically do not move lactating animals from different states to Wisconsin. We typically move springing heifers, which means, you know, pregnant heifers that will then calve and then enter the lactational string. We want to watch those cows, and really, if possible, we want to have them isolated or put into maybe a quarantine facility on the farm And we want to look for feed intake. We also want to look for fevers. And if you have any questions or you're seeing any type of abnormal health change, to contact your veterinarian. We've been putting out lots of information for all of our bovine veterinarians. It's a pretty small community in Wisconsin, and we're blessed with some of the best bovine veterinarians in the country. But call your vet. The Department of Animal Health is another great place to call. And then, of course, the university and the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is a great resource. You can check our website as well.
How do we do when it comes to biosecurity in dairy farms on Wisconsin, Keith? Because I could see an argument being like, hey, these cows are people's livelihood. They're going to be really careful. I could see this is a low margin industry. Maybe things fall by the wayside. Maybe that includes biosecurity in general. From what you see out there, how do we do on that?
I think dairy in general and across the country could always do better. I think we're far behind the swine and poultry industries because those two industries have really been forced to really tighten up their biosecurity because of things like highly pathogenic avian influenza. Our dairy cows, we really haven't seen something like this in the past. There's lots of information out there about how to tighten up biosecurity. Most of it was developed to maintain business continuity during a foot and mouth disease outbreak, which we haven't seen since the 1920s. But it's, you know, at securemilksupply.org and securebeef.org, we have lots of different plans to be able to tighten up security. And then through the American Association of Bovine Practitioners and the National Milk Producers Federation, we've linked to this on our website as well. And we have really kind of cleaned up the biosecurity guidelines from foot and mouth disease and made them very easy to understand. I would have any animal dairy producer go download those guidelines, contact your veterinarian. They probably aren't going to be able to do all of them, but every little bit helps. And I think that's something that we're always working with our dairy producers to tighten up biosecurity because it does have a good return on investment. And then it protects you or protects your herd and your farm and your livelihood and the community and the economy of the state by being prepared.
Keith, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity. Please let me know if you have any questions.
That's Keith Polson, director of the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, clinical associate professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, with us to break down news of confirmed cases of a bird flu found in some dairy cattle around the country, and at least, as we heard one person, what it means for agriculture and public health. Wisconsin has fewer coal-burning power plants today than in the past, and utilities are planning to retire more plants in the next few years. As Joe Schultz reports, those closures are part of a move to reduce carbon emissions. They could also create new opportunities for development at the former plant sites.
In 2021, the Dairyland Power Cooperative decommissioned its coal-burning power plant in Genoa. Last month, local officials and utility staff members watched from a nearby bluff as they used explosives to demolish it. A large smokestack crashes to the ground as smoke and dust rise from the remains. Leaders of the utility are still planning what's next for the site. Brent Ridge is the CEO of Dairyland.
We're going to be looking for economic development opportunities that could range from manufacturing all the way to another power-generating resource.
The Genoa plant isn't unique. The state had 13 large-scale coal plants in 2005. It had 7 as of 2020. That's according to the State Public Service Commission. 3 more are expected to come offline by 2026. Scientists say burning coal to generate electricity is a big contributor to climate change. Utilities say they're committed to reducing carbon emissions, but their goals are voluntary. They aren't mandated by state law. In 2022, both We Energies and Alliant pushed back plant retirements, citing supply chain issues for solar components. Environmental groups say it's imperative that utilities move away from coal as quickly as possible to mitigate the worst effects of climate change. Utilities have pledged to go carbon neutral by 2050.
If it wasn't important to our customers, it wouldn't be important to us. So we're not going fast enough for some of them. Some of them, we're going probably too fast.
That's J.P. Brummond, an executive with Alliant Energy. The utility plans to take its Edgewater generating station in Sheboygan County offline next year. The site sits along Lake Michigan. Trains coming into its rail yard carry coal that will be burned to generate electricity. Inside, industrial piping lines many of the walls and ceilings. Operations manager Terry Dumez points to a diagram outlining the plant's layout and process for converting coal to electricity.
It's pulverized coal. It comes out basically like powder after it goes through the pulverizer. It just gets blown, transported with air.
The utility has had early discussions with local officials and hired a consultant to help come up with a plan for the site's future. Meanwhile, a former coal plant in southeast Wisconsin is expected to see new life in the coming years. We Energies tore down its plant in Pleasant Prairie in 2022. Last month, it sold the site to Nevada-based developer Dermody Properties. Dermody plans to convert the site into a three-building industrial campus. Neil Driscoll is with the developer. He says the site's infrastructure factored into those plans.
It gives us really good opportunities to tap into the power that's in the area, which is a big factor and, quite frankly, is a growing one with everyone's interest in data centers.
A former Alliant Energy plant in Beloit has had a second life since it came offline in the 2010s. While the site once sounded like this, it now sounds like this. When the Blackhawk Generating Station closed, Beloit College saw opportunity in the century-old building. The college struck a deal in 2014, allowing it to convert the site into a fitness and student center. The center opened in 2020. It still features coal hoppers, a control panel, and industrial piping. Beloit College even saved the plant's smokestack, though it no longer produces billowing clouds. Dan Schoof is with the college. He says there's something symbolic about the project.
It was polluting for a purpose to generate power, but it did a lot of damage in the community, as all coal plants did. And so for us now to take that and be a place of learning, that's a different kind of energy.
Despite the closure of coal plants, environmental groups are critical of some utilities' plans to replace them with natural gas plants. They say more work is needed to get to zero carbon emissions. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about that story and see all the latest from our news and talk teams over at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.